relatively pure throughout the ages, whereas those that are more yang and involved in worldly affairs have degraded markedly, until the militant extremist faction of the most aggressive religions has actually sunk below the critical level of integrity at 200. The more dualistic the creed, the greater seems to be its vulnerability to misinterpretation. Dualism promotes a split between belief and action and the discernment of levels of truth. When this occurs, the spiritual essence can be confused in translation into physical expression. Thus, the conceptual Christian soldier, parenthesis of the spirit, end of parenthesis, becomes, through a distorted literal translation, a self-justified battlefield killer. The Hindus did not fall into the error of confusing levels of interpretation. The battle described in the opening of the Bhagavad Gita was never misinterpreted to suggest Lord Krishna teaches that believers are to engage in actual warfare. The Buddha's view that the cause of all pain and suffering is ignorance, which he saw as the only sin possible, and that one's duty is to be compassionate towards others and pray for them, is hardly susceptible of such distortion. The downfall of all lofty spiritual teachings has been their misinterpretation by the less enlightened. Each level of consciousness predefines its own limited capacity for perception and comprehension. Until one has oneself become enlightened or at least experienced the higher states of consciousness, all spiritual teachings remain hearsay and are thus prone to distortion and misunderstanding. Scripture can be quoted to justify any position. The so-called righteous are always dangerous because of their imbalanced perception and their consequent indifference to moral violence. Within any religion, fundamentalist sects always calibrate the lowest, often operating at the same level of consciousness as criminality. Their hallmark is egocentric extremism and irrationality. But with 85% of the human population calibrating below the critical level of 200, error is easily disseminated and readily accepted around the world. Cults proliferate because the general public has no objective criterion with which to distinguish truth from falsehood. Using the tools of this study, we may identify as a cult any purportedly spiritual movement that calibrates below the level of 200. As we have seen above, cults are not just isolated renegade phenomena. They also thrive as tolerated subgroups within the world's great religions, distorting teachings and subverting their intent. Cults, indeed, need not be formally religious at all. The ultimate cult, of course, is that of anti-religion, based on anti-divinity, which we know as Satanism. It has no explicit religious agenda of its own, as it defines itself through antithesis and reversal of benign principles. In one form or another, it has always been with us. As up implies down, and light implies darkness, man's socially organized search for truth and commitment to higher spiritual levels has also implied the socially organized promulgation of falsehood and submission to the lowest energy fields. Examination of the nature of anti-religion demonstrates, in fact, the enormously destructive power of negative energy fields, and examples are unfortunately ready at hand. The trappings of disguised Satanism spread as fashions of a pop youth subculture, its primary vehicle being an overt musical style. But principles are implicit in trappings, and principles generate attractor fields. The effects are all too familiar to any clinician practicing near an urban area. The destruction of energy fields is pathogenic. Victims become desensitized to distinctions between good and evil, a value inversion which can be clinically examined. Habitués are found to directly display the so-called blown-out acupuncture system and desynchronization of the cerebral hemispheres in response to repetitive negative patterns of the associated music. The net result is, in effect, a hypnotic trance during which the listener is highly susceptible to the violent and blasphemous suggestion of the lyrics. In this sense, these children become literally enslaved, prone to later bouts of irrational destruction, in which they, in truth, really don't know why they act as they do, as they are acting out unconscious post-hypnotic suggestions, but the influence persists. Continued weakening of the body and its immune system, long after the music stops, is accompanied by an inversion of kinesiological response. Negative stimuli that would make a normal person go weak paradoxically cause a strong response, while those that would make a normal person go strong now produce a weak response. Unaware that they are the victims of a potent negative energy field, the members of this subculture sink into sometimes inescapable subservience to forces beyond their comprehension. Youth subjected to such physical, emotional, and sexual abuse can suffer permanent damage to the brain's neurotransmitter balance and become adult depressives who habitually seek out abusive partners and must endlessly struggle against an inclination to suicide that is, in fact, a lingering form of post-hypnotic suggestion. We may wish to deny that such a spiritual plague, reminiscent of the Dark Ages, could still remain virulent in our seemingly enlightened society. But such perverse influences do not operate in a moral vacuum or arise from a social matrix that does not already incorporate preconditions for their growth. The paradox of a puritanical society is that it encourages constant seduction but denies satisfaction, so a perpetual frustration of normal outlets eventually finds release in perverse ones. If we look more closely, we may find that other elements of what we call civilization, in fact, also fosters its persistence. While the young are being programmed by the specialized TV and computer games that glorify violence, their parents are being brainwashed by adult media. Kinesiologic testing showed a fairly typical TV serial caused test subjects to go weak multiple times during a single episode. Each of these weakening events suppressed the observer's immune system. Each weakening reflected an insult to the viewer's central as well as autonomic nervous systems. Invariably accompanying each of these disruptions of the acupuncture system were suppressions of the thymus gland. Each insult also resulted in damage to the brain's delicate neurohormonal and neurotransmitter systems. Each negative input brought the watcher closer to eventual sickness and to depression, now one of the world's most prevalent illnesses. Subtle grades of subclinical depression kill more people than all the other illnesses of mankind combined. There is no antidepressant that will cure depression, which is spiritually based, because the malaise does not originate from brain dysfunction, but from an accurate response to the desecration of life. The body is the reflection of the spirit in its physical expression, and its problems are dramatization of the struggles of the spirit which gives it life. A belief that we ascribe to out there has its effect in here. Everyone dies by his own hand. That is a hard clinical fact, not a moral view.
Chapter 23, The Search for Truth Continued.
The attempt to impose standards of would-be absolute good and evil is, in fact, one of the great moral pitfalls. But without moralizing, we can plainly state that whatever calibrates above 200 supports life and therefore may be functionally defined as good, whereas whatever calibrates below 200 is destructive, non-supportive of life, and can thus be declared functionally negative. By testing, we can prove that a false premise such as the end justifies the means is operationally negative, yet this is a routine accepted justification for much of human behavior, from the peccadilloes of commerce to the enormities of war. Such spiritual ambiguity, leading ultimately to irretrievable confusion between functional good and evil, has always been the Achilles heel of human society. It is this process of perversion of truth through a failure of discernment which has provided the instrumentation of the decline in the world's great religions, as noted above. Religions which fall below the level of 500 may preach love, but they will not be able to practice it. And no religious system which encourages war can claim spiritual authority without the blatant hypocrisy that has made atheists of many honest men. Society is collectively most vulnerable when the capacity to distinguish between attractors and imitators, or to perceive nuances of different levels of consciousness, is dulled. Thus, do civil abuses become law, and political extremists persuade with righteous slogans. The children of violence become its perpetrators because a confused society, which has lost the capacity for discernment necessary to protect its own consciousness, can hardly hope to protect its young. An individual's level of consciousness is determined by the principles to which they are committed. To maintain progress in consciousness, there can be no wavering about principle, or the individual will fall back to a lower level. Expediency is never an adequate justification. If it is wrong to kill another human being, that principle can allow no exceptions, regardless how emotionally appealing a construct may be used to justify the exception. Thus, a society which condones capital punishment will always have a problem with murder. Both are products of the same level of perception. To the murderer, the killing of the victim is also a justifiable exception. Once a principle is breached, its mutated form propagates like cancer. A society which supports killing, whether in war or by the police or by the penal system, cannot at the same time effectively stop so-called criminal killing. To kill is to kill is to kill. There is no escaping the fact. The decision to kill or not is a basic issue on the path to real power. But this rudimentary step has not even been essayed by 85% of the world's population or by virtually any of its governments. Coco, the famous gorilla, who is a resident of the Primate Research Institute, has worked for years with a psychologist and developed a sophisticated sign language vocabulary. She is truthful, affectionate, intelligent, and trustworthy. Her integrity calibrates at 250. Thus, one is safer with the gorilla Coco than with 85% of the humans on the planet. Injury to man's so-called spiritual eye has resulted in dimness of moral vision and blindness to truth, which afflict 85% of the Earth's population, who linger below that critical level of integrity. The great issue that confronts mankind as a whole is the healing of this spiritual blindness. The more immediate problem of so-called right and wrong that always diverts our societal focus only exists as a function of perception based on the lower levels of consciousness. Little children are taught that dangerous behaviors are wrong, but as they grow older, discernment should replace moralism. Whether it is wrong to kill other human beings may be a moral dilemma at lower levels of consciousness. At higher levels, the very question is ridiculous and not even conceivable. Conventional morality is, therefore, only a provisional substitute for a faculty of higher consciousness. Moralism, a byproduct of duality, becomes insignificant as the consciousness level rises through the 500s and becomes irrelevant at the level of 600. Merely to reach a stage where one functions primarily from reason requires a major evolution in consciousness to the 400s, a very powerful level in world society. Freud, Einstein, and Descartes calibrated at 499, which is also the level of humanism. But reason, so vulnerable to loss of perspective through self-absorption, has in the long run never provided man any solid moral or even intellectual certitude. Again and again it has, to the contrary, led from the chaos of ignorance to an equally baffling cerebral maze. In a world of mass confusion, we desperately need a reliable, accurate, objectively verifiable yardstick through which to measure truth. Hopefully this study has presented such a tool. Any increased infusion of the influence of truth into the collective human consciousness gives us cause for greater hope than may be apparent from what tends inevitably to be a rather gloomy overview. We have established that consciousness is capable of discerning any change of energy to a degree of log 10 to the minus infinity. This means that there is no possible event in the entire universe not detectable by the exquisite sensitivity of consciousness itself. The energy of human thought, though minute, is nevertheless absolutely measurable. A thought which emanates from the consciousness level 100 will typically measure between log 10 to the minus 800 million to 10 to the minus 700 million microwatts. On the other hand, the loving thought at the consciousness level of 500 measures approximately log 10 than the minus 35 million microwatts. Although only 15% of the world's population is above the critical consciousness level of 200, the collective power of that 15% has the weight to counterbalance the negativity of the remaining 85% of the world's population. Because the scale of power advances logarithmically, a single avatar at a consciousness level of 1,000 can, in fact, and does totally counterbalance the collective negativity of all of mankind. Kinesiologic testing has shown that one individual at level 700 counterbalances 70 million individuals below level 200. One individual at level 600 counterbalances 10 million individuals below level 200. One individual at level 500 counterbalances 750,000 persons below level 200. One individual at level 400 counterbalances 400,000 individuals below level 200. One individual at level 300 counterbalances 90,000 persons below level 200. 12 individuals at level 700 equal one avatar at calibrated level 1,000. There were at the times of the writing of the book 12 persons on the planet who calibrated over 600. At this time, however, there are only six. Three between 600 and 700, one between 700 and 800, one between 800 and 900, and one between 900 and 1,000. May 2006. Were it not for these counterbalances, mankind would self-destruct out of the sheer mass of its unopposed negativity. However, the difference in power between a loving thought and a fearful thought is so enormous as to be beyond the capacity of the human imagination to even comprehend. We can see from the analysis, however, that even a few loving thoughts during the course of the day more than counterbalance all of our negative thoughts by their sheer power. From a social behavioral viewpoint, as we said, truth is a set of principles by which people live, regardless what they might say they believe. We have seen that there is subjective truth, operational truth, hypothetical truth, intellectual truth, and then there is so-called factual truth. The legitimacy of any of these is dependent on the context of a given perceptual level. Truth is not functional unless it is meaningful, and meaning, like value, is dependent on a unique perceptual field. Facts and data may be convincing at one level and irrelevant at another. Functional validity of information received also varies with the intellectual level and capacity for abstraction of the mind of the recipient. To be operational, truth must be not simply true, but knowable. Yet each level of truth is unknowable to the levels below it and has no validity beyond its own territory. Thus, we can conclude that all kinds of truth as we know it within the dimension of ordinary human function are examples of dependent truth, whose veracity is totally contingent on a given set of parameters or context. Even our revered so-called scientific truth is also truth by definition only under certain conditions, and therefore subject to dispute and error. Statistical inference has become a propaganda tool, and the statistical distortions by which anything can be proven about anything have alienated our credence. Is there any impersonal truth, independent of individual condition or context? Truth as detected by the research methods explained throughout this book derive its validity from ultimate sources far beyond the influence of any localized perceptual field. It represents neither personality nor opinion and does not vary with any condition of test subject or environment. Ignorance does not yield to attack, but it dissipates in the light, and nothing dissolves dishonesty faster than the simple act of revealing the truth. The only way to enhance one's power in the world is by increasing one's integrity, understanding, and capacity for compassion. If the diverse populations of mankind can be brought to this realization, the survival of human society and the happiness of its members are more secure. The initial effect of taking responsibility for the truth of one's life is to raise lower energy field levels to 200, the critical level at which power first appears, and the stepping stone to all the higher levels. The courage to face truth leads eventually to acceptance, where greater power arises at the level of 350. Here, then, there is sufficient energy to solve the majority of man's social problems. This, in turn, leads to the yet greater power available at level 500, which is the level of love. Knowing our own and everyone else's human foibles gives rise to forgiveness and thence to compassion. Compassion is the doorway to grace and to the final realization of who we are, why we are here, and the ultimate source of all existence.
Chapter 24, Resolution.
A thorough absorption of the material presented herein has been shown to be able to raise one's level of consciousness by an average of 35 points. Inasmuch as the progression of consciousness during the average human lifetime lived on this planet has been only 5 points, such an increase of 35 in individual awareness is of enormous benefit in and of itself. And as advanced theoretical physics and nonlinear dynamics have shown, any individual increase also raises to some degree the consciousness of everyone on the planet. To become more conscious is the greatest gift anyone can give to the world. Moreover, in a ripple effect, the gift comes back to its source. While the level of consciousness of mankind as a whole stood at a perilous 190 for many centuries, as we have seen, in the late 1980s, it suddenly jumped to the hopeful level of 204. For the first time in history, man is now on safe ground from which to continue his upward march, and this promise of new hope comes none too soon. Today, many of the subjects we have discussed are exploding in the news media: the perversion of religion to the ends of political savagery, the deepening depravity of crimes, the involvement of children in violence, moral confusion in politics, and the bizarre violence of cults all appear against a backdrop colored by the prevalence of lies as social tender and a lack of consensus as to individual and collective responsibility towards one's fellow man. This social confusion and paralysis stems from the dearth of guidelines upon which to base decisions. Hopefully this book has taken a step towards filling that void with what is, in fact, an essay on the science of morality. By using the term morality, we do not refer to merely petty moralistic judgments of right and wrong, but to an at once objective and personal basis from which to make decisions and evaluations regarding the highest conduct of our lives. In a social framework, we can certainly choose to refuse passive acquiescence to any political system that falls below the level of 200. Instead, applying it to our newly developed faculties of examination and correction, it is now possible, for instance, to establish clear criteria by which holders of public office should be selected. Each office requires a specific minimum level of awareness in order to be effective. In general, any government official who falls below 200 will not solve problems but create them. The larger social issue is how, in view of the dark side of mankind's behavior, one can maintain compassion. It is a relative world. Everyone acts from his own level of truth, and therefore believes that their own actions and decisions are right. It is this very so-called rightness that makes fanatics so dangerous. But the real danger to society does not come from overt bigotry, such as even white supremacism, which calibrates at 150. As such, damage can at least be monitored. The really grave danger to society lies in the silent and invisible entrainment that stealthily conquers the psyche. In the process of entrainment of the public consciousness, negative attractor fields are cosmeticized by rhetoric and manipulation of symbols. Moreover, it is not the overt message of the negative input that destroys consciousness, but the energy field that accompanies it. The extreme negativity of many popular works of pseudo-philosophy, for example, is obvious if one tests these books. But even being forewarned cannot defend us against unwitting entrainment by invisible energy fields, which are activated when these works are read. One may think he can maintain his psychic independence by refuting the work intellectually, but mere exposure to the material has a profound negative effect that continues even after the material is intellectually rejected. It is as though there is within these negative influences a hidden virus whose invasion of our psyche goes unnoticed and undetected. Additionally, we often relax our circumspection when encountering material that ascribes to itself the attributes of spiritual insight or religion, forgetting that every heinous crime of which man is capable has been perpetrated in the name of God. While violent cults may be clearly repellent, belief systems that masquerade as piety are even more insidious, for they corrupt by the silent entrainment of invisible attractor fields. Here it is best to heed the traditional wisdom that tells us not to fear evil or fight it, but merely to avoid it. But in order to avoid it, one has to have the capacity to recognize it. Socrates said, in effect, that without such capacity, youth, including the youth that continues to reside within every adult, is corrupted by lower attractor energy fields. Though he was put to death for teaching this discernment, his teaching remains. Obscurity is dispelled by augmenting the light of discernment, not by attacking the darkness. The final issue, then, is the problem of how we may best cultivate and preserve the power of moral discernment. Our journey of investigation has finally led us to the most critical realization of all, that mankind actually lacks the capacity to recognize the difference between good and evil. By humbly surrendering to this awareness, man may be forearmed. When we admit we are gullible and easily seduced by the senses and deluded by glamour, including intellectual glamour, we have at least the beginning of discernment. Fortunately, in this world of duality, man has been given a consciousness which can instantly detect that which is destructive and signal it to his otherwise ignorant mind by the grossly visible weakening of his body in the presence of inimical stimuli. Wisdom can ultimately be reduced to the simple process of avoiding that which makes you go weak. Nothing else is really required. Through frequent practice of this technique, spiritual blindness to the discernment of truth from falsehood can be progressively replaced by a growing intuitive vision. Some lucky few seem born with this innate capacity. Their lives remain clear and undamaged by negative entrainment. But for most of us, life has not been that easy. We have spent a great deal of time in repairing the damage done by destructive attractor fields, which have acted almost unconsciously and hypnotically. Recovering even from a single addiction can take up the majority of a single lifetime. And the most common and insidious addiction is to denial, which plagues all of mankind through intellectual vanity. The intellect, contrary to its delusions of grandeur, not only lacks the ability to recognize falsehood, but lacks the necessary power to defend itself, even if it had the capacity of discernment. Is it irrelevant, in light of history's enormous accretion of works of intellectual speculation, to say that man's vaunted capacity of reason lacks that critical faculty of discernment? The whole field of philosophy is merely evidence that man has struggled and failed for thousands of years to arrive at the simplest recognition of what is true and what is false, or the discourse would long ago have reached some consensus. And it is clear from common human conduct that even if the intellect could reliably arrive at this basic conclusion, it still lacks the power to stop the effect of negative fields. We remain unconscious of the causes of our afflictions, while the intellect dreams up all kinds of plausible excuses, hypnotized itself by these same forces. Even when a person intellectually knows his behavior is self-destructive, this knowledge has no necessary deterrent effect whatsoever. Intellectual recognition of our addictions has never given us the power to control them. In Scripture, we are told that man is afflicted by forces unseen. It is a commonplace observation of our century that silent, invisible rays of energy are emitted even by innocent-looking objects. The discoverers of radium paid for this realization with their lives. X-rays are lethal, and radioactive emissions kill silently, as does radon. The attractor energy fields that destroy us are equally invisible and no less powerful, though far more subtle. When it is said that someone is possessed, what is meant is that his consciousness has become dominated by negative attractor fields from which the person cannot extricate themselves. By this definition, we can see that whole segments of society are so thoroughly possessed that they themselves are unconscious of their own motives. Wisdom tells us one worships either heaven or hell, and will eventually become the servant of one or the other. Hell is not a condition imposed by a judgmental God, but rather the inevitable consequence of one's own decisions. Hell is the final outcome of constantly choosing the negative, and thus isolating oneself from love and truth. Enlightened beings have always described the general populace as being trapped in a dream, and the majority of people are driven by unseen forces, and most are in despair over this fact a great deal of their lives. We pray to God to relieve us of the burden of our sins, and by confession we look for relief. Remorse seems woven into the fabric of life. How can salvation be possible, then, for those who have unwittingly become ensnared in such destructive influences? However, in fact, even from a merely scientific viewpoint, salvation is indeed possible. In truth, it is guaranteed by the simple fact that the energy of a loving thought is enormously more powerful than that of a negative one. Therefore, the traditional solutions of love and prayer have a sound scientific basis. Man has within his own essence the power of his own salvation. Humanity could be called an affliction from which we are all burdened. We don't remember asking to be born, and we inherited a mind so limited it is hardly capable of distinguishing between that which embraces life and that which leads to death. The whole struggle of life is in transcending this myopia. We cannot enter into higher levels of existence until we advance in consciousness to the point where we overcome duality and are no longer earthbound. Perhaps it is because of our collective will to transcend that we have earned the capacity to finally discover an inborn compass to lead us out of the darkness of ignorance. We needed something very simple which could bypass those traps of the wily intellect, for which we have paid such an enormous price. This compass merely says yes or no. It tells us that that which is aligned with heaven makes us go strong, and that which is aligned with hell makes us go weak. The ubiquitous human ego is actually not an I at all, it is merely an it. Seeing through this illusion reveals an endless cosmic joke, in which the human tragedy itself is part of the comedy. The irony of human experience is in how fiercely the ego fights to preserve the illusion of being a separate individual I, even though this is not only an ontologic impossibility, but the very wellspring of all suffering. Human reason exhausts itself ceaselessly to explain the inexplicable. Explanation itself is high comedy, as preposterous as trying to see the back of one's own head. But the vanity of the ego is boundless, and it becomes even more overblown in this very attempt to make sense of nonsense. The mind, in its identity with the ego, cannot by definition comprehend reality. If it could, it would instantly dissolve itself upon recognition of its own illusory nature and basis. It is only beyond the paradox of mind transcending ego that that which is stands forth as self-evident and dazzling in its infinite absoluteness. And then all these words are useless. But perhaps from compassion for each other's blindness, we can learn to forgive ourselves. Peace can then be our assured future. Our purpose on earth may remain obscure, but the road henceforth is clear. With the consciousness level of humanity now finally above 200, we may expect great transformations throughout human culture as mankind becomes more responsible for his knowledge and thus its deeds. We have become fully accountable whether we like it or not. We are at the point in the evolution of our collective awareness where we may even assume stewardship of consciousness itself. Humanity is no longer resigned to passively paying the price of ignorance, or its communal consciousness would not have risen to its new level. From this time forth, man may choose to no longer be enslaved by darkness. His destiny can then be certain. Gloria in excelsis Deo.
This concludes Disc 6. Disc 7, About the Author. Biographical and Autobiographical Notes. Dr. Hawkins is an internationally known spiritual teacher, author, and speaker on the subject of advanced spiritual states, consciousness research, and the realization of the presence of God as Self with a capital S. His published works, as well as recorded lectures, have been widely recognized as unique in that a very advanced state of spiritual awareness occurred in an individual with a scientific and clinical background, who was later able to verbalize and explain the unusual phenomenon in a manner that is clear and comprehensible. The transition from the normal ego state of mind to its elimination by the presence is described in the trilogy Power vs. Force, published in 1995, which won praise even from Mother Teresa, The Eye of the Eye, 2001, and I, Reality and Subjectivity, 2003, which have been translated and are available worldwide in foreign editions. The trilogy was preceded by research on the nature of consciousness and published as a doctoral dissertation, Qualitative and Quantitative Analysis and Calibration of the Levels of Consciousness, 1995, which correlated the seemingly disparate domains of science and spirituality. This was accomplished by the major discovery of a technique that, for the first time in human history, demonstrated a means to discern truth from falsehood. The importance of the initial work was given recognition by its very favorable and extensive review in Brain Mind Bulletin, and at later presentations, such as the International Conference on Science and Consciousness. Many presentations were given to a variety of organizations, spiritual conferences, church groups, nuns and monks, both nationally and in foreign countries, including the Oxford Forum. In the Far East, Dr. Hawkins is a recognized teacher of the way to enlightenment. In response to his observation that much spiritual truth has been misunderstood over the ages due to lack of explanation, Dr. Hawkins presented monthly seminars and provided detailed explanations that are too lengthy to describe here. Recordings of these lectures are available. The overall design of this lifetime work is to recontextualize the human experience in terms of the evolution of consciousness and to integrate a comprehension of both mind and spirit as expressions of the innate divinity that is the substrate and ongoing source of life and existence. This dedication is signified by the statement, Gloria in excelsis Deo, with which his published works begin and end. Biographic summary. Dr. Hawkins has practiced psychiatry since 1952 and is a life member of the American Psychiatric Association and numerous other professional organizations. His national television appearance schedule has included the McNeil Lear News Hour, the Barbara Walters Show, The Today Show, science documentaries, and many others. He is the author of numerous scientific and spiritual publications, books, videotapes, and lecture series. Nobelist Linus Pauling co-authored his landmark book, Orthomolecular Psychiatry. Dr. Hawkins's diverse background as researcher and teacher is noted in his biographical listings in Who's Who in America and Who's Who in the World. He was a consultant for many years to Episcopal and Catholic dioceses, the monastery, monastic orders, and the Zen monastery. Dr. Hawkins has lectured widely, with appearances at Westminster Abbey, the Universities of Argentina, Notre Dame in Michigan, Fordham, and Harvard Universities, and the Oxford Forum. He gave the annual Landsberg Lecture at the University of California Medical School at San Francisco. He is also a consultant to foreign governments on international diplomacy and has been instrumental in resolving long-standing conflicts that were major threats to world peace. In recognition of his contributions to humanity, Dr. Hawkins became a knight of the Sovereign Order of the Hospitallers of St. John of Jerusalem, which was founded in 1077. Dr. Hawkins relates that while the truths reported in this book were scientifically derived and objectively organized, like all truths, they were first experienced personally. A lifelong sequence of intense states of awareness, beginning at a young age, first inspired and then gave direction to the process of subjective realization that has finally taken form in power versus force. At age 3, there occurred a sudden full consciousness of existence, a nonverbal but complete understanding of the meaning of I am, followed immediately by the frightening realization that I might not have come into existence at all. This was an instant awakening from oblivion into a conscious awareness, and in that moment, the personal self was born, and the duality of is and is not entered his subjective awareness. Throughout childhood and early adolescence, the paradox of existence and the question of the reality of the self remained a repeated concern. The personal self would sometimes begin slipping back into a greater impersonal self with a capital S. And the initial fear of non-existence, the fundamental fear of nothingness, would recur. In 1939, as a paperboy with a 17-mile bicycle route in rural Wisconsin, on a dark winter's night, Dr. Hawkins was caught miles from home in a 20-below-zero blizzard. His bicycle fell over on the ice, and the fierce wind ripped the newspapers out of the handlebar basket, blowing them across the ice-covered snowy field. There were tears of frustration and exhaustion, and his clothes were frozen stiff. To get out of the wind, he broke through the icy crust of a high snowbank, dug out a space, and crawled into it. Soon the shivering stopped, and he experienced a delicious warmth, and then a state of peace beyond all description. This was accompanied by a suffusion of light and a presence of infinite love that had no beginning and no end and was undifferentiated from his own essence. His physical body and surroundings faded as his awareness was fused with this all-present, illuminated state. His mind grew silent. All thought stopped. An infinite presence was all that was or could be, beyond all time or description. After that timelessness, there was suddenly an awareness of someone shaking his knee. Then his father's anxious face appeared. There was great reluctance to return to the body and all that that entailed, but because of his father's love and anguish, the spirit nurtured and reactivated the body. There was compassion for his father's fear of death, although at the same time, the concept of death seemed absurd. This subjective experience was not discussed with anyone since there was no context available from which to describe it. It was not common to hear of spiritual experiences other than those reported in the lives of saints. But after this experience, the accepted reality of the world began to seem only provisional. Traditional religious teachings lost significance and, paradoxically, he became an agnostic. Compared to the light of divinity that had illuminated all existence, the God of traditional religion shone dully indeed. Thus, spirituality replaced religion. During World War II, hazardous duty on a minesweeper often brought close brushes with death, but there was no fear of it. It was as though death had lost its authenticity. After the war, fascinated by the complexities of the mind and wanting to study psychiatry, he worked his way through medical school. His training psychoanalyst, a professor at Columbia University, was also an agnostic. They both took a dim view of religion. The analysis went well, as did Dr. Hawkins' career, and success followed. He did not, however, settle quietly into professional life. He fell ill with a progressive, fatal illness that did not respond to any treatments available. By age 38, he was in extremis and knew he was about to die. He didn't care about the body, but his spirit was in a state of extreme anguish and despair. As the final moment approached, the thought flashed through his mind, "What if there is a God?" So he called out in prayer, "If there is a God, I ask him to help me now." He surrendered to whatever God there might be and went into oblivion. When he awoke, a transformation of such enormity had taken place that he was struck dumb with awe. The person he had been no longer existed. There was no personal self or ego, only an infinite presence of such unlimited power that it was all that was. This presence had replaced what had been me, and the body and its actions were controlled solely by the infinite will of the presence. The world was illuminated by the clarity of an infinite oneness that expressed itself as all things revealed in their infinite beauty and perfection. As life went on, the stillness persisted. There was no personal will. The physical body went about its business under the direction of the infinitely powerful but exquisitely gentle will of the presence. In that state, there was no need to think about anything. All truth was self-evident, and no conceptualization was necessary or even possible. At the same time, the physical nervous system felt extremely overtaxed, as though it were carrying far more energy than its circuits had been designed for. It was not possible to function effectively in the world. All ordinary motivations had disappeared, along with all fear and anxiety. There was nothing to seek, as all was perfect. Fame, success, and money were meaningless. Friends urged the pragmatic return to clinical practice, but there was no ordinary motivation to do so. There was now the ability to perceive the reality that underlay personalities. The origin of emotional sickness lay in people's belief that they were their personalities. And so, as though of its own, a clinical practice resumed and eventually became huge. People came from all over the United States. The practice had 2,000 outpatients, which required more than 50 therapists and other employees, a suite of 25 offices, and research and electroencephalic laboratories. There were 1,000 new patients a year. In addition, there were appearances on radio and network television shows. In 1973, the clinical research was documented in a traditional format in the book Orthomolecular Psychiatry. This work was 10 years ahead of its time and created something of a stir. The overall condition of his nervous system improved slowly, and then another phenomenon commenced. There was a sweet, delicious band of energy continuously flowing up the spine and into the brain, where it created an intense sensation of continuous pleasure. Everything in life happened by synchronicity, evolving in perfect harmony. The miraculous was commonplace. The origin of what the world would call miracles was the presence, not the personal self. What remained of the personal me was only a witness to these phenomena. The greater I, deeper than the former self or thoughts, determined all that happened. The states that were present had been reported by others throughout history and led to the investigation of spiritual teachings, including those of the Buddha, enlightened sages, Huang Po, and more recent teachers such as Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj. It was thus confirmed that these experiences were not unique. The Bhagavad Gita now made complete sense. At times, the same spiritual ecstasy reported by Sri Ramakrishna and the Christian saints occurred. Everything and everyone in the world was luminous and exquisitely beautiful. All living beings became radiant and expressed this radiance in stillness and splendor. It was apparent that all mankind is actually motivated by inner love, but has simply become unaware. Most lives are lived as though by sleepers, unawakened to the awareness of who they really are. People around him looked as though they were asleep and were incredibly beautiful. It was like being in love with everyone. He found it necessary to stop the habitual practice of meditating for an hour in the morning and then again before dinner, because it would intensify the bliss to such an extent that it was not possible to function. An experience similar to the one that had occurred in the snowbank as a boy would recur, and it became increasingly difficult to leave that state and return to the world. The incredible beauty of all things shone forth in all their perfection, and where the world saw ugliness, there was only timeless beauty. This spiritual love suffused all perception, and all boundaries between here and there, then and now, or separation, disappeared. During the year spent in inner silence, the strength of the presence grew. Life was no longer personal. A personal will no longer existed. The personal I had become an instrument of the infinite presence and went about and did as it was willed. People felt an extraordinary peace in the aura of that presence. Seekers sought answers, but as there was no longer any such individual as David, they were actually finessing answers from their own self, with a capital S, which was not different from his. From each person, the same self shone forth from their eyes. The miraculous happened beyond ordinary comprehension. Many chronic maladies from which the body had suffered for years disappeared. Eyesight spontaneously normalized, and there was no longer a need for his lifetime bifocals. Occasionally, an exquisitely blissful energy, an infinite love, would suddenly begin to radiate from the heart towards the scene of some calamity. Once, while driving on a highway, this exquisite energy began to beam out of his chest. As the car rounded a bend, there was an auto accident. The wheels of the overturned car were still spinning. The energy passed with great intensity into the occupants of the car and then stopped of its own accord. Another time, while he was walking on the streets of a strange city, the energy started to flow down the block ahead and arrived at the scene of an incipient gang fight. The combatants fell back and began to laugh, and again the energy stopped. Profound changes of perception came without warning in improbable circumstances. While dining alone at Rothman's on Long Island, the presence suddenly intensified until everything and every person, which had appeared as separate in ordinary perception, melted into a timeless universality and oneness. In the motionless silence, it became obvious that there are no events or things, and that nothing actually happens, because past, present, and future are merely artifacts of perception, as is the illusion of a separate I being subject to birth and death. As the limited, false self dissolved into the universal self, with a capital S, of its true origin, there was an ineffable sense of having returned home to a state of absolute peace and relief from all suffering. It is only the illusion of individuality that is the origin of all suffering. When one realizes that one is the universe, complete and at one with all that is, forever without end, then no further suffering is possible. Patients came to Dr. Hawkins from every country in the world, and some were the most hopeless of the hopeless. Grotesque, writhing, wrapped in wet sheets for transport from faraway hospitals they came, hoping for treatment for advanced psychosis and grave incurable mental disorders. Some were catatonic. Many had been mute for years. But in each patient, beneath the crippled appearance, was the shining essence of love and beauty, perhaps so obscured to ordinary vision that he or she had become totally unloved in this world. One day a mute catatonic was brought into the hospital in a straitjacket. She had a severe neurological disorder and was unable to stand. Squirming on the floor, she went into spasms and her eyes rolled back in her head. Her hair was matted. She had torn all her clothes and uttered guttural sounds. Her family was fairly wealthy. As a result, over the years she had been seen by innumerable physicians and famous specialists from all over the world. Every treatment had been tried on her, and she had been given up as hopeless by the medical profession. A short, nonverbal question arose. "What do you want done with her, God?" Then came the realization that she just needed to be loved. That was all. Her inner self shone through her eyes, and the self, with a capital S, connected with that loving essence. In that second, she was healed by her own recognition of who she really was. What happened to her mind or body didn't matter to her any longer. This, in essence, occurred with countless patients. Some recovered in the eyes of the world, and some did not. But whether a clinical recovery ensued didn't matter any longer to the patients. Their inner agony was over. As they felt loved and at peace within, their pain stopped. This phenomenon can only be explained by saying that the compassion of the presence recontextualized each patient's reality so that he or she experienced healing on a level that transcended the world and its appearances. The inner peace of the self encompassed Dr. Hawkins and his patients beyond time and identity. It was clear that all pain and suffering arises solely from the ego and not from God. This truth was silently communicated to the minds of the patients. This was the mental block in another mute catatonic who had not spoken in many years. The self said to him through mind, "You're blaming God for what your ego has done to you." The patient jumped off the floor and began to speak, much to the shock of the nurse who witnessed the incident. The work became increasingly taxing and eventually overwhelming. Patients were backed up, waiting for beds to open, although the hospital had built an extra ward to house them. There was an enormous frustration in that the human suffering could be countered in only one patient at a time. It was like bailing out the sea. It seemed that there must be some other way to address the causes of the common malaise, the endless stream of spiritual distress and human suffering. This led to the study of kinesiology, which revealed an amazing discovery. It was the wormhole between two universes, the physical world and the world of the mind and spirit, an interface between dimensions. In a world full of sleepers lost from their source, here was a tool to recover and demonstrate for all to see that lost connection with the higher reality. This led to the testing of every substance, thought, and concept that could be brought to mind. The endeavor was aided by his students and research assistants. Then a major discovery was made. Whereas all subjects went weak from negative stimuli, such as fluorescent lights, pesticides, and artificial sweeteners, students of spiritual disciplines who had advanced their levels of awareness did not go weak as did ordinary people. Something important and decisive had shifted in their consciousness. It apparently occurred as they realized they were not at the mercy of the world, but rather affected only by what their minds believed. Perhaps the very process of progress toward enlightenment could be shown to increase man's ability to resist the vicissitudes of existence, including illness. The self had the capacity to change things in the world by merely envisioning them. Love changed the world each time it replaced non-love. The entire scheme of civilization could be profoundly altered by focusing this power of love at a very specific point. Whenever this happened, history bifurcated down new roads. To Dr. Hawkins, it now appeared that these crucial insights could not only be communicated with the world, but visibly and irrefutably demonstrated. It seemed that the great tragedy of human life had always been that the psyche is so easily deceived. Discord and strife have been the inevitable consequence of man's inability to distinguish